Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight we'll go back in time, the seasons pass, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score which would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats, football history and its memorabilia on the Gridiron Greats Publishing and Broadcasting Network. In conjunction with Slick Enterprises, we're live from the Wallingford, Connecticut home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. And I'm Bob Slick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America which focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 150-plus years of football history and memorabilia. You'll find us on the web at gridirongreatsmagazine.com. It's at this time I'd like to introduce my co-host. He's a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Largan. He hails from Portland, Oregon. Mr. Joe Squires. Joe, welcome to the show this evening.
Great to be here, Captain. Very excited for this show. We have a great lineup.
Very excited myself too, Joe, and we're back. It's 2020, and we're in for our all-new 2020 season of Gridiron Greats, the podcast. I can't wait.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of great shows.
Yep.
A lot of great shows coming up. We're going to lead off tonight talking about an incredible, unopened box of cards. However, they're not football-related. Fill us in, Joe.
A one-off from football for sure, Bob. Well, it was pointed out to us, Mile High has in her upcoming auction a partial box of 1933 R-136 National Chicle Skybirds. It apparently comes, they're penny packs, comes 100 packs to a box, and there are 91 unopened Skybird packs in this box. What does it have to do with Gridiron Greats football, you ask? Well, National Chicle, their first foray into, into the card business was this 1933 Skybird. So next was the 1935 Chicle. So it kind of gives us collectors a little glimmer of hope. There's a box of National Chicle Skybirds. Could there be a box of National 35 National Chicle football out there? There's just never been seen. There's wrappers that we've seen, but no one's ever seen an unopened wax pack. And definitely my white whale, the 35 Chicle uncut sheet. But it just gives you that glimmer of hope, I guess, like finding water on Mars.
Now, I'm curious, do you have any idea what the box is currently going for? How many millions of dollars, if at all?
Let me look here, Bob. I took a snapshot of it. I believe their auction's not open yet, is it? Or no, it
oh,
is.
It's not,
running.
Okay.
Hang on a second. Let me look. I took a snapshot. It is at $26,804, not including VIG. So, yeah, that's cheap. Yeah, I would agree with you. Written on the box is received in 1933. So, not to say that can't be faked, but I mean, these are penny packs. I mean, it's pretty easy to look through the wrapper. I mean, there's a lot of design on it, but so little is known about the Chickles. I mean, were Chickles penny packs? Were they nickel packs? Was there gum? I would imagine there was gum in there. It's National Chickle gum. So, they're considered, so we can imagine. But, and the topic came up, what would an unopened pack of 35 Chickle go for? And we know that the Chickles were issued, originally with the first series, a.k.a. the first 24 cards were issued. And then later on, the second series, the second 12 cards came. We know that the first 24 cards have, nearly quadruple the population of the second series, 12 cards. But, I mean, after they came out the other 12 cards, did they start mixing them up? And, could you get a nickel pack with, some first series cards in there, a couple second series cards, including the ultimate card, the number 34 Nagurski. It's just there's not a lot known. I mean, if it's a one card, penny pack with gum up against it, I mean, you take something that's 90 years old like that, and obviously there's going to be gum stain. So, but I don't know.
I think, in my opinion, I truly believe there's unopened 35 National Chickle football out there. And I think it hasn't come to the market. It's one of those undisturbed finds and or someone has been holding on to it. And I really predict that something is like that out there. Now, what will be interesting to see as a parallel, whoever wins these 91 packs, okay, so what are you going to do? Are you going to try to encapsulate all 91 packs and get them graded? Are you going to actually open something to see what's in it? Are you going to just keep it intact? So on and so forth. So, what I find interesting is the way it's being marketed as the 91 packs, complete in the box, as one lot. I personally think it might have been, I don't know. I would have broken it up to have a few people get it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then just break everything down and then sell it and sell the box separately, sell packs separately, so on and so forth. But I'm not the auctioneer, so therefore, we have no input whatsoever on it. But I do predict that'll probably break 100,000 with the buyer's premium on it easily.
Yeah.
Making each pack
30,
that expensive.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, 33 Chickle Skybirds is a very popular set. I mean, I've heard of it.
Yeah.
I don't collect a lot of non-sports, but I've heard of it. I think it's beautiful. It's a stunning set. So it's not a very thinly traded set. So, I mean, there's some dry powder out there that that people have, that something like this comes along, this once in forever. I mean, and there's people it hits that realm of must have. But you remember what was it like? 13, 15 years ago, somebody discovered several cello packs. Their uncle worked for Topps in 1955 and had taken a couple boxes of cello. So for decades, the number one set had a bunch of PSA 9s. And all of a sudden, this gentleman came along, and he, you know, started getting PSA 10s graded, and he easily took over the number one spot, but suddenly just,
right,
you know, everything we knew about this All-American set was busted wide open just by this one great find of, you know, an uncle worked for Topps, brought some boxes home, stuffed it in an attic, or, you know, stuffed it in a closet, excuse me, and years later it was discovered. I mean, I agree,
right,
with you, Bob. There's a box, there's a pack, there's a something, and my fingers are crossed. There's an uncut, you know, sheet. I don't care if it's printer's proof. I don't care if it's blank back. There's an uncut sheet of National Chickle out there somewhere, and you want to talk about a must-have. If one of those appeared, that would be, I'd start recycling cans the next day to save up.
Right. I went through some older notes I had today, knowing we were going to talk about the Chickles, and I go back about 12 years to a fella who contacted me via email at the time, and he basically just collected the 35 Chickle set. I didn't write down his name for whatever reason. I'm very surprised about it. But he bought all my Chickles at the time, so this was roughly 2008. I remember setting up at the Baltimore National the last time it was there, and I had a bunch of Chickles with me, and I remember one guy ended up buying them all. And I said to him straight out, I said, you wouldn't happen to be a guy who bought from me. I introduced myself. And he says, oh, yeah, you are the guy I bought them from. So I said, is that all you collect? He says, yeah, I only collect 1935 National Chickles. So I said, are you hoarding them?
Wow.
And he says, not really. He said, I buy them, and I keep trying to put more and more sets together. He wouldn't disclose how many sets he had. And again, I never took his name down. I don't remember, but he was from the Maryland area, so I thought that was pretty interesting. So anyways, it popped in my mind, and I went into my notes today since we were going to talk about the Skybird. I'm wondering if that type of person is somebody who might have, you know, the wrapper hidden away, or have the
display box,
wax pack hidden, that'd be fascinating if it did. So
I've just always thought of these historic finds like this. Like, you know, somebody will come forth four or five packs, and it'll be, you know, my dad, my grandfather, you know, was 13. He lived in Philadelphia. You know, he bought these packs when he was a kid and put them in his shoebox. You know, we found the shoebox, you know, et cetera. I mean, as morbid as it sounds, you know, they put it in a shoebox. He died of polio, and they something like that. And you know, it's out there. You know, it's like a glimmer of hope. You know, it's life. It's, you know, for us hobbyists. I mean, you know, I've collected wax packs at various times. I still go on eBay every once in a while and do a little eBay search and think about it and go, nope, 50% of those are bad. But discovering Chickle wax, I mean, it'd be incredible. And like I've said before, you know, reach out to me. If anyone out there has a line on a 35 Chickle uncut sheet, I'm a buyer. I'm a buyer. And you've got a whale on the end of the hook. So, you know, I'll take it. I know my station in this hobby. So it would just be an incredible find. I mean, I just go back to the 48 leaf, you know, partial uncut sheet that I bought a decade ago, and I paid whatever the guy was asking, didn't hesitate. I've never looked back, and I've never seen another one since. So,
your 48 leaf is rare of rare. I mean, it's a 1-of-1, and again, that's a really good example because again, how many are out there? Probably two, maybe.
Yeah.
Yours and somebody's something that's buried somewhere type of thing. So it's really incredible one way or the other if you think about it that, you know, this came to the market and, you know, we'll see where the price actually ends up. You know, I predict with the buyer's premium well over $100,000. I could be way off. I mean, this could be a $200,000-$300,000 sale. Who knows, you know?
I was trying to think about because we've never known. We're pretty sure 35 Chickle was cut on, you know, on 24 you know, I'm 24, you know, card uncut sheets, and then 12
right,
later.
Right.
So they were, you know, single printed later with, you know, with the, you know, half of the first series. I started playing around because, you know, the Skybird is, you know, a series of 144, but only 108, you know, cards were actually issued. So if you take a 24, you know, card uncut sheet and you multiply by 6, you get 144 cards, which is what the series of 144 would be, I would imagine. So they had 6, you know, sheet runs. But there is no 108 divisible by 24. It ends up being, you know,
right,
4
right.
and a half, really. So, I mean, obviously there's some, you know, some double print cards, or not double print, I guess. There's some cards that were only done every other sheet, you know, is
right.
the only way the math
right.
works out if it's a 24 card uncut sheet,
right.
which is weird. It'd be, I love the Skybird, but I'm not that into the set. So it'd be interesting to look at what the short prints are, you know, in the set. And I'd be willing to bet you could do the math and figure out which 12 cards were on the tail end of that, you know, fourth sheet, you know, that were only
mm-hmm.
single printed.
Mm-hmm.
So,
truly amazing.
But I still maintain that, and we're both in agreement, there are still hidden gems in the market. There are still things waiting to be found. As much as so many different things have been found, there's still, still avenues, there's still places to look. And,
yeah.
You know, never know what's going to come out there one way or the other. And, again, it'll be nice for the hobby to really confirm the 35 Chickle all-around distribution somehow, the printed sheet somehow, the wax pack somehow, so on and so forth. So that's something to definitely look forward to. I really hope we can it will happen one day, and we'll see it. It'll truly be amazing, to say the least. And, yeah, no, and that's not to say, too, there's still going to be other stuff out there, you know, from the late 40s, 50s, and early 60s that are just lurking out there waiting to be found. And that'll have a strong impact on the hobby also at the same time. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens in the long run. And I know you have announced tonight, if there is a 35 uncut sheet out there, you would like to purchase it, and I'll be the go-between for contacting my co-host.
Reach out to Bob at Gridiron Grades. Yeah, trust me, I'd appreciate it. I won't give my email address. It's way too complicated, and I'd have to explain it to too many people. But it's that's why I use my work email address most of the time, Bob. Yeah, I think most people gave up on my Hotmail address. It does give us hope, doesn't it? I mean, you think about there's a convenience store, a convenience store like 5-6 years ago, and I forget what they found, but you know, in the back, you know, somebody was cleaning out the shelves, and stuffed in the way back was, you know, something like a 48 Bowman box, you know, with 10 packs in it. And I forget what year it was, but it's just, and they're like, man, no one's ever cleaned that shelf. You know, and you think about it, you're like, all right, 60 years, no one's ever cleaned that shelf. I mean, and they've been sitting there. It gives you hope that, you know, in a convenience store, in a shoebox, in an attic, somewhere, there's some 35 Chickle wax packs stuffed in a closet,
hidden.
You know, somewhere as an uncut sheet. So a printer, somebody worked for Chickle, and they're a printer. Somebody brought sheets home and showed them to their kids, and those kids rolled them up and put them somewhere.
Amazing.
We've heard many amazing stories of, you know, the dad who was the printer who brought stuff home and showed the kids. I mean, we had a guest previously who, you know, whose dad worked and, you know, showed him stuff. Was it? Leland?
Right.
Was that Josh? I think it was Josh, wasn't it? Oh, anyways. But, yeah. But really cool. Just a historic thing. And I like Mile High. They've always ended up with really cool things. And it's, you know, it's a cool auction, you know, time right now. You've got, you know, the tail end of Heritage, you know, Mile High Huggins starts here in a little while. They just opened their preview up. It didn't look like there was very good stuff in there. And Huggins usually has one or two cool things, but looks like they kind of drew a blank on this one. But, oh, well, even Michael Jordan missed free throws.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing one way or the other what will come out, and it'll be amazing to see in the long run, you know, what this is going to go for in the market. So it's it'll be interesting one way or the other. So, all right, it's at this time. I'd like to introduce our special guest. He is the founder and CEO of Ebbetsfield Flannels. I'd like to introduce to our show tonight, Mr. Jerry Cohen. Jerry, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. How are you guys?
We're good. We're good.
Great.
Sorry, I called in just a minute late.
No problem.
No worries.
No problem.
Jerry, thanks for being on the show. I'm a huge fan of your website. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks.
Jerry, I'd like to start off by asking you, how did you start Ebbetsfield Flannels? Can you give our listeners some background?
Yeah. It was a long time ago in the pre-internet dawn of time in the late 80s, if anybody out there remembers that. I was at the time just looking for one of the old flannel baseball shirts for myself, basically to wear on stage. I was playing in bands at the time, actually still do, but I had a kind of a background in baseball history just as an amateur, you know, fan, and I loved growing up graphics, all sports graphics, but mostly baseball. So long story short is I couldn't find what I wanted, and I tried a few things, a little ads in magazines I responded to, and was frustrated, and that made me mad, and that made me obsessed. And one thing led to another, and had a few shirts made for myself, and then people wanted to buy them. And so that's what started Ebbetsfield Flannels back in 1988.
Wow!
You had a quote somewhere, Jerry, that was, you know, a fruitless search for vintage flannel baseball jerseys led to, you know, the formation of Ebbet. I really like that, the fruitless search. That's almost how I found you. I've been looking for like Red Grange and Jim Thorpe jerseys, and I stumbled across your Canton Bulldog, you know, jerseys. You know, about a month ago, and I was, you know, 2 hours later, I'm done looking at your website. It was an amazing rabbit hole to go down.
Well, we appreciate that. Thorpe is, as you know, an interesting character because he was such an integral part of sports in the early 20th century, not just obviously in the Olympics, but he played professional baseball as well as football. And we've actually done a few jerseys that he wore at different times. You know, back in an earlier version of the company, or an earlier time in the company, we made his Oorang Indians jersey as well in the 1920s NFL, you know, when they had teams go in and out of the league for like a single season for 10 years or so.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Jerry, this is the one place you can nerd out. Yeah. And this is probably the only other place you'd be able to mention the Oorang Indians, and we know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, not many people would.
That's very true.
Obviously,
that's
you're a huge, yeah. Obviously, you're a huge baseball fan. I mean, Ebbets Field, you know, historic field, you know, in New York. You know, and I know you get your inspiration from looking at, you know, some old baseball cards and just seeing the vintage uniforms. Do you collect football related?
I am not a collector in that traditional sense. Like it's a profession for me. So any desires I have for as a hobby really kind of went a long time ago. When I was a kid, the cards were important because, you know, back in the 60s, a lot of people would have trouble relating to this, but we actually didn't even have a color television yet. So to see, you know, all of my early days of watching sports were on black and white television in the you know, mid late 60s.
Oh, wow.
And yeah. Therefore the cards, I would love to get the baseball cards, especially because you could see the uniforms in color. and that was the only place other than you know, some magazines like Sports Illustrated that you actually saw the color. So that was my relationship to cards. Unfortunately, it was not by, if I had been smarter and had more foresight, I would have collected player cards that became valuable, but I didn't care about the players. I only cared about the uniforms. So unfortunately, wow. I don't have a valuable baseball card collection.
That goes back to my story. When I was a kid, I used to put the football cards on the top of the TV set for the two teams that were playing. So I had a good handle seeing what the uniforms were actually in color. And I was always mesmerized because living in Connecticut in the middle of winter and the 4 o'clock game is from the West Coast. And I would always ask my father, why is it nice over there? Why is it snowing over there? Type of thing.
Yeah.
And that's definitely a memory of growing up in the 60s. That's for sure.
Yep.
Jerry, do you remember what year baseball set that was that you remembered that you kind of became enamored and hooked on in baseball?
What set?
What year? Yeah, what year set was it? I mean, because what had 51? I think 52 tops obviously was color. 53.
Yeah, no, it was much later because it was concurrent with me being a fan in the I lived in New Jersey in near New York City. So I was a Mets fan back then because my dad was a Brooklyn Dodger fan. So you could see where the name of the company comes from. But so we inherited the Mets as kind of the replacement team.
Yeah.
And so I was a National League fan. So the American League teams, for example, were very exotic to me because although we got Yankee games on TV, I didn't really watch them. So I wasn't as familiar with the uniforms. But to answer your question, this would have been more in 66, 67, 68, that period that I started to really see the cards. I always remember that for some reason I would end up with, was it Joe Brinkman from the Washington Senators? I don't know why, but I must have had eight or 10 of those damn ones just randomly.
You've done a great job of losing your New Jersey accent, Jerry. Congratulations.
Yeah, well, I've been on the West Coast for so long that I just more or less have the generic Western U.S. accent now.
Totally.
Jerry, you say your company saying it's vintage authentics and it shows how you produce everything. Can you tell us about the process if someone came to you with a custom jersey request, for example? What research might you be doing? How does the process actually work?
Well, we're pretty limited in what we can do, what we call custom, and some people are disappointed because they like to draw something on the back of a napkin and have us create it for them, and we're not, you know, doesn't really work for this kind of thing. So for custom for us is, let's say, they had a grandfather or a relative who played minor league baseball for some obscure team, and they send us a picture. It's always black and white. And we can convert that and, you know, use our skills and our eyes doing this research for 30 years and accurately recreate that jersey, although sometimes there might be some guesswork involved on the colors. But basically, there's just – either we have the research or the customer will send it in terms of custom. We have to disappoint a lot of people because people want a very elaborate one-off hockey jersey sometimes, and they don't really understand that that's something that has to be programmed into a knitting machine. And to do that for a one-piece order is not really possible, at any reasonable price. So we're pretty limited on those custom ones or what we're calling custom to flannel baseball jerseys, you know, football, if it's not too complicated, you know, fortunately most football jerseys were, you know, simple sleeve stripe patterns and we have most of those already programmed. But if they want a hockey jersey with very elaborate three color striping on the body, that's something we need, you know, a dozen pieces at least to be able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But the process really is usually that there's usually not an original garment we can look at. That of course makes it very easy, but we have a very good archive of athletic fonts. We know what the patterns were. We know what the manufacturers did at any given time. So you know, with our background, we can usually do what people want.
That's
you had a really fascinating video.
To make this point, I like collecting. I have a handful of athletic equipment catalogs.
Yeah.
For football, and I always thought that was, you know, for guys who collect footballs and helmets and stuff like that, that's a great reference tool as far as looking at the stuff. So I'll assume like older magazines would probably be something that could be used also to say, you know, for example, an old pro football from magazine from the 40s or whatever might have some pictures of the uniforms or whatever. Do you have those kind of items on file? I'm just curious.
We do. It's fairly random. It's not like any vast archive of them that I can look at. But, you know, our earlier years were really focused on baseball. So those files, I still have the physical, you know, files in alphabetical order by city, you know, filing cabinet.
Mm-hmm.
After that, you know, when the internet started to take over, you know, I save anything I find, I save in a folder in various different places, and then I could usually refer to it quickly. But in terms of magazines, yeah, we have a lot of them, but they're kind of random, one from this year, one from that year. They're not like a collection of a lot of them in any. They're very just, you know, it's very difficult to find that stuff. I did used to buy these old, like you mentioned, the athletic catalogs, so Wilson Spalding and many of the ones that are no longer with us. I have several of those, and they're really wonderful resources. Some of them the illustrations were just gorgeous. And what people don't really realize is that, for example, in the 1930s and 1940s, speaking just about football, football uniforms or jerseys were offered in maybe 10 fabrics. You know, they were, you know, lightweight wool, heavyweight wool. The Dereen fabric started to become available much earlier than even I realized. In the late 30s, they were already offering the Dereen, which, to those who don't know, Dereen was a plated cotton and rayon or nylon that started to supplant the wool. By the 50s, pretty much all of it had, you know, wool was pretty much gone in football. But anyway, some of these catalogs are quite spectacular, and they're great resources.
Gosh, can you imagine wearing a wool uniform in the South playing football?
You know, if you really look at our football jerseys, as well as some from the time, they're not as uncomfortable or as heavy as you may assume. Jersey knit, which is actually a technical term, is a much finer knit than, say, sweater knit. The wool was not that chunky. It was very tightly woven, and it actually had a lot of give to it. So, and even the flannel baseball uniforms, particularly of the 50s and 60s, were very, very lightweight and very comfortable. People assume that the wool was gone because of comfort, but this is one thing that I never tire of correcting this mythology, is that when baseball switched out of the wool flannels, it wasn't for comfort. The double knit polyesters that initially replaced them were actually heavier, and they didn't breathe in the heat. So the idea was not so much the player comfort, it was the ease of care, where a wool jersey would have to be stitched back together if it was, for example, torn, because it was a woven fabric. The polyester double knits would just pop back into shape, and you could throw them in a dryer, which you couldn't do with the wool ones. So it really had nothing to do with comfort. The flannels, if you look at pictures of Mickey Mantle, that era in particular, Roger Maris, Mantle, the 60s, Willie Mays, those guys were wearing extremely lightweight flannels that had synthetics blended into them. And they were cut, you know, in such a way as to provide a lot of comfort and a lot of breathability. And the polyesters, on the other hand, in the early 70s were very heavy, and they were form-fitting. So you see the V-necks and the three-color elastic belts and all that stuff. So that was really the change. It was more of an ease of care than it was a comfort issue.
Wow. Well, you know your uniforms and fabrics, Jerry.
Well, you know, we believe in wool, really, so we really just hate when people say, "Oh, how do they wear those?" Because we're trying to sell wool.
Wow. No, it's amazing. I love it. You touched briefly on just customization of certain things. And I'd mentioned in our email exchange, I've been searching for a long time for an authentic Red Grange jersey from his playing days at Illinois. It's a colorful uniform with stripes on the arms. It's beautiful. I had never been able to find it. And that's, you know, so I was asking about the process of, like, you know, if, you know, there's a custom jersey. I mean, but one that you could probably, you know, take vertical and stock or something. What's the process like if somebody comes with something like that?
So I'm looking now that you were talking about it. So he did wear what we call the friction cloth jersey, which, you know, the one with the strips and the V
on the arm.
Yeah, that is extremely, that is the one that we have really tried to crack. And the reason is, though, that they used to call those, okay, so for folks who don't know, if you've seen, like, pictures of 1920s football, particularly college football, a player will have a bunch of strips of cloth sewn usually in a pattern on top of the jersey and on the arms of the jersey. That was supposedly to give the ball carriers more grip ability when they held the football. And often you'll see a team picture where only about half the players are wearing the strips of cloth, and that's because the players who were not eligible to carry the ball didn't need them, and they were just a solid jersey. So again, referring back to what I was just talking about in the we learned this from looking at the athletic catalogs from the manufacturers. That was called friction cloth, and they used a few different fabrics to do it. One was called airplane cloth, and one was called friction cloth, and it had little ridges in it. You can't always see it in the picture, so it kind of had a rough texture. So anyway, unfortunately, none of that stuff is available. You know, you'd have to get some company to actually manufacture that cloth. You can fake it a little bit with canvas. But because you would need to cut it into strips, the process to try to create that Red Grange would just, you know, we've done it for people, but it's just such a pain. And it all has to be manually cut and then cut into that pattern so that the different strips create that shape. I've seen in colleges sometimes they would even form a big letter out of that cloth, like North Dakota had a giant N in the friction cloth.
Oh, wow.
I'm looking now at Red Grange. And as I said, I think earlier in an email, we have made his New York Yankees jersey with his 77 for when he actually left the Bears. He was, you know, too big a star and wanted his own league, basically. So his agent actually started the American Football League, the original American Football League, as a rival to the NFL, and Red Grange was signed to headquarter their flagship team, which was the New York Yankees.
Yeah, but Jerry, who was his agent?
I knew you were going to ask me that, and
hey,
name,
you're a football crowd, brother.
Pyle, C.C. Pyle.
Do you see Cash and Carry Pyle? Nice.
Yep, that's right.
Cash and Carry.
It came out of my brain from somewhere, but and we go on. I love this obscure stuff. But the AFL, the Yankees were very successful, but most of the other teams in the AFL were totally riding on Red Grange's fame.
Oh, yeah.
It's almost like if Will Chamberlain had gone to the ABA and that was the only well-known player they had. So whenever Red Grange was in town, they'd fill the stadium, but the rest of the time they struggled. So I think he went back to the Bears after that.
After he blew a knee out,
exactly.
They played his old team, the Bears. He blew a knee out and took a year off, made some really crappy movies, and then went back to the Bears as a defensive back and, you know, running back. Yeah. Yeah, you're in a safe place here, Jerry. We can talk football, we can talk grain, popcorn.
Yeah.
So in other words, the Illinois jersey would just be too hard. But I mean, if somebody came to you and said, you know, if somebody like me came to you and said, I love that jersey, what would the price be? I mean, because you
well,
said
for that one,
for people.
You know, to hand cut all those pieces of canvas and put that, it'd probably be a $500 project to knit the thing and stitch it together and then stitch on. It really comes down to the hand labor. That's what you're paying for.
Yeah.
More than, in that case, we had a guy, must have been 4 years ago, and I regretted taking that damn order. It was just cursed because he gave us plenty of time, which people don't often do for custom work. But he did give us enough time, but he wanted one of those Red Grange jerseys for his whole family. So he ordered like six of them. And he needed them for Christmas. He needed them for Christmas, and we thought we could do it. And we went down to the wire, and I just remember all that damn canvas and scissors and, you know, trying to match those things up. It was a nightmare. We did get it to him, so we did get it done, but we undercharged him because we had no idea when we took the order of how long it would take to make those.
Oh,
so I wish there was an easier way to do those because I happen to personally really love that style of jersey. I think they're great.
Ditto. I'd love to order one. Well, we'll take that offline. I'd love to firm up an order of a Red Grange Illinois jersey.
All right.
It's my favorite jersey. It's one I've been looking for, and so we'll take that offline. But I want to wear that to the next national, just so everybody can go, where the hell did you get that cool jersey? And I'll go, Ebbets, baby, Ebbets. You have really good blogs, you know, on your website. Again, I spent a couple hours on your website. I'm that guy. And one of your first blogs was about the Pacific Coast League. I live in Portland, just a little bit south of you. And I love that you had your favorite hat pick, Jerry's hat. And it was the San Francisco Seals, and I hadn't heard of them, so I looked at it a little bit. Obviously, the Portland Beavers down here were part of the PCL, and Jim Thorpe played, you know, here in 1916, which is a little tidbit, played for the Beavers for 1 year. PC, what's your history at the PCL, the San Francisco Seals, and why no love?
The PCL is huge for us. I mean, when I moved to Seattle in '86, I learned about the Rainiers, which was the Seattle team up till the ill-fated Pilots were here for 1 year. But the PCL, I mean, there's not enough time probably to really get into it. But what your listeners should know about it was, until the mid '50s, there were only 16 Major League Baseball teams, and in 10 cities, all of them east of St. Louis. So, and minor league baseball was structured differently then. They were not, people have a hard time understanding that the minor league teams were mostly independent. So they weren't what you would call farm teams. They made deals with major league teams and they sold players, but they were not totally a part of their organization. So the setting for the Coast League, the Coast League was obviously up and down the West Coast, San Diego to Seattle, and all the major cities in between. But the baseball culture was every bit as rich as it was in the two major leagues. And a lot of the players, frankly, didn't want to play Major League Baseball because, you know, in the Coast League, for a long time, they played 200 games a year because of the weather was good, and they could stay home near their families. They didn't have to take a, you know, another job, and you know, some great players like Joe DiMaggio, Ted Williams, just to name two, came out of the Coast League, and were stars in the Coast League before they went to the majors, and so the baseball tradition on the coast was they had their own thing. What really changed it was television of major league games started to be broadcast into the Coast League cities and other big minor league cities in the early 50s, and it killed attendance because suddenly people were staying home. Whereas earlier, you know, if you look at the attendance for the post-World War II Pacific Coast League, there were years where some of the Coast League teams outdrew the St. Louis Browns in the majors.
Wow.
I mean, L.A. had two teams, Hollywood and the original Angels, L.A. Angels. The Bay Area had three teams at one point, Oakland, San Francisco, and Mission. And then there were Sacramento, San Diego, Seattle, and Portland. So the Coast League was huge. Great players, great managers, great ballparks for the most part, and great uniforms, which is another thing about it. They tended to be a little more colorful than their major league counterparts. Now, of course, the Dodgers and Giants, you know, the Coast League, what was going to happen, it's kind of an alternate history of baseball. The Coast League got certified as open classification. So in other words, instead of AAA, they basically were exempted from the MLB draft, and the plan was to certify them as the third major league. Well, Walter O'Malley had a slightly different idea and moved his Brooklyn Dodgers team and got Horace Stoneham to move the New York Giants to the West Coast, and that killed the Coast League in terms of it being a major league because they took out the two biggest territories. Huh. And after that, the Coast League became – you know, currently still a regular, what I call a regular minor league. But before that, it was independent. And you're right about Thorpe playing there briefly. Portland was a great franchise. And in fact, I believe the Portland Beavers, who are sadly no more, were the last of the classic eight Coast League cities to stay. Portland was there through the 90s.
Yep, they shut down in, I think, 2003 or 2004. Got MLS soccer. So
they destroyed Civic Stadium, well, from my point of view, because where left field was, they added a soccer grandstand. So you can't play baseball there anymore.
Yeah.
I have a really good picture of Thorpe wearing that Portland jersey, standing, in the field that hangs in my office, and then going to your website and seeing that Portland jersey was really cool. It was just, and you can see in your website, the photos are amazing. You can see, you can feel the texture of the fabric. The picture is so high def, you can see the texture, and, just looking at the picture, you can feel, quickly feel it. It's just, it's very
It's great. One good thing that the internet has done is much better quality photos are available than when I started. I mean, I literally went to for the first two or three years of our business, I would go to the Baseball Hall of Fame library in the wintertime when it pretty much was shut down. But it was still open, but the town was basically shut down. And I just photographed every sporting news and every magazine and photograph that was in there. But I ended up with a lot of stuff, but it was very poor quality in a lot of times. And for what I do, the difference between a blurry black and white photo and a really highly detailed one, like you mentioned, is night and day. Because, for example, sometimes you can't tell initially that it's pinstripe fabric, except on a better quality, richer toned picture, where you can pick up details like that. Details of embroidery and sleeve patches, all that stuff. The quality of the photo is really, really key.
Another amazing thing has done is cat videos, Jerry. Cat videos, the internet's brought to us.
Cat videos, is that right? I'll get on that.
Yeah. Pretty amazing.
Jerry, what are some of the biggest football sellers for you, for your company?
Well, this is relatively new because we just got our NFL license last year, second half of the year. So early, the definitely Bart Starr Green Bay Packers jersey is, we only go up to 1960. So you have to remember that our time frame is fairly limited. And that's not up to us necessarily. That's just the scope of our license with the NFL. In terms of football, NFL football, the Boston Patriots. It's funny. Social media is great. Someone posted comment on our page mocking us for calling them the Boston Patriots. As if we don't know what we're doing. I resisted responding, and fortunately one of my other customers educated the person and said, you might want to check your history, because they were the Boston Patriots for several years before they were New England. So, but the 1960 Boston Patriots is a big seller. The Bart Starr 59 Packers, we do pretty well with the Browns. 52 Browns. I'm just looking here. You know what? The Bills. You know, those first year AFL teams were really, really fun.
Yeah.
And then Frank Gifford, 58 New York Giants, the white one with the red stripes, is always a favorite of mine. So those are probably. Oh, the Jim Otto Oakland Raiders. And we've had other people, so-called, you know, we've had people correct us, quote-unquote, on the Raiders, saying they were never gold. Well, they were. 1963 is when Al Davis took over the team and changed their colors to black and silver. So, so stuff like that. In terms of the wool jerseys, collegiate jerseys, that's a little different. I think the Princeton jersey is one of our most popular, and the Army jersey.
That's cool. That just warmed my heart, Jerry. Those are some really good jerseys you listed.
Thank you.
So, do you have a favorite? I mean, and is your top seller usually your favorite? Do they coincide?
I have my own favorites aesthetically, and sometimes they're not the ones that are the most obvious sales-wise. But, for example, in NFL, let me look here. I haven't talked about the NFL. The earlier NFL were wool. We don't sell as many of the wool, but I love that Sammy Baugh Washington jersey from 48, even though it's very plain. The number style is really great. Even though it's very odd, the 34 Detroit Lions is really cool. Just that Honolulu blue, and it's the big weird number 7 on it. And I love, you know, I'm a Giants fan, sadly, New York Giants, but, the 33 Giants with the body stripes are a little bit like the Montreal Canadiens almost. Very unusual. I mean, I had a Giants fan go crazy and say, why are you making that jersey? Nobody wants that jersey, blah, blah, blah. Well, I made it because I like it. Because when you own the company, you have some privileges. And all the Giant jerseys from that period that were associated with more winning teams were all plain blue, you know, solid blue or solid red. Quite a few. I like the Packers. You know, they've worn throwback versions of this Packers with the navy blue with the little circle with the number on it. So those are some of my own favorites.
Well, you just named some good ones. That Detroit Lion Bobby Lane, you know, number 7 jersey. You know,
I love that one.
That's good looking.
Yeah, I wish I was able to do the. That's the road. I think I didn't do the home because, you know, these are all yarns.
Right.
And if you don't have the exact shade available, you know, and to make that Honolulu blue yarn, we'd have to order so many thousands of pounds of the yarn to make one jersey. So we kind of got around that by doing the white version with just the blue stripes on the sleeve, where it didn't call for. So those, you know, we didn't talk about this, but there are some technical challenges sometimes to doing some of these historic things, because in terms of wool or these Doreen jerseys, you know, you actually have to have specialty yarns.
Yeah.
You can't just go down to the yarn store down the street and buy it, you know.
Just hearing you say, like, the Sammy Baugh, you know, that from the Redskins, I'm a huge Sammy Baugh fan, so I can envision that jersey. That's cool.
Amazing.
Your You're living the dream, Jerry. A lot of people dream about doing what you do, and you're doing it, my man. I'm jealous.
Well, it's a lot of fun. It's still very, very gratifying to make these things come alive.
Yeah.
Jerry, we're almost out of time, but I'd like to ask where our listeners can contact you as far as your store is concerned. Do you have a store, or is it just online?
We're mostly online. We have a small, fat kind of outlet store in Seattle, in Pioneer Square area, if people know where that is. But ebbets.com, that's 2 B's, 1 T, no, not 2 T's, EBBETS.com is the website. You can see all the stuff we talked about. And, you know, our emails and stuff are there. So if anyone wants to contact me with a custom order, I'm the guy who reads those custom order emails still. So happy to entertain anybody's idea of a custom or, you know, anything else on our site, obviously.
Wow. That's great.
The world is there for customization. So, yeah, I'll be reaching out to you about that Grange, Illinois one.
Great.
A little later today, but... Man, I can't wait. Like I said, I ordered my Thorpe Canton Bulldog one. I got the sweater. I'm waiting for the jersey to show up. So you guys do custom make them. So
we do.
Being patient.
They do take time sometimes. Yeah. Thanks very much, you guys.
No hurry. No worry. I don't need it for Christmas.
All right. Take care.
Jerry,
bye-bye.
Thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Jerry Cohen,
wow.
CEO of Ebbets Field Flannel. Wow, what an education. That was amazing. So we're really pressed for time now. So within 2 minutes, Joe, I'm going to hand off to you immediately. What'd you pick up on tonight's show?
Wow. Kid in a candy store, Bob. Just imagine having that job, just getting to, like, hey, you walk you out to the factory floor. Hey, gentlemen, need a Sammy Baugh jersey. Just absolutely cool. I just, that's pretty cool. Yeah, it was fun to hear him start talking about Red Grange, you know, and if I, you know, just, you know, it'd be like, you know, talking about the law at a lawyer's convention. It's just, you know, it was fun to hear him, you know, go down that street. And it's like, yeah, this is the one place you can nerd out on these things, and you're in good company.
Yeah,
it's kind of funny.
And
you know,
to me, it parallels all those jersey and uniform collectors out there who search everywhere to try to find these, you know, find these jerseys, find these, you know, game day capes, stuff like that. And that's what it comes to mind with. For me, you know, listening to them. And to me, it's great because it does preserve the history of the game. And, you know, somebody walking down the street with a 1933 Lions jersey could be saying, what team is that? I never saw anything like that. And, you know, and you never know
yeah.
what's going to happen from there. That's the very interesting part of it. So, but it was very interesting to hear the process and to hear, you know, what really goes into that process of making these jerseys. I mean, it's amazing, to say the least.
The video.
Right, we got about
the video on their website.
Left.
Oh, yep. The video on their website really goes into detail about, you know, cutting the fabric,
yeah.
stitching it. It's pretty fascinating.
And again, a lot of this stuff is special ordered. You got to buy X amount, so on and so forth. So you know, it's not just like calling the guy up and say, all right, I need this jersey by Friday. It's not going to happen
yeah.
type of thing. You know?
Yeah.
There's a lot involved in it, to say the least. So this is very, very interesting, very educational tonight. We're going to be back with our second show of January very soon and wrapping this up. Again, something very different than what we're normally used to. As far as a guest, but it was very educational. And Joe, I thank you for doing the legwork on it and obtaining him as a guest for tonight's show. So it was very good, very interesting, and I enjoyed seeing the jerseys you picked up. You sent me a few pictures of them, so that was pretty cool, to say the least.
All right, we're almost out of time. I'd like to thank everybody for listening. Remember, gridirongridsmagazine.com if you're not a subscriber, and you can check out our website, and we'll give you all the subscription and back issue information. Joe, final thoughts real quick. 5 seconds.
Best seat in the house, Bob, always.
Amazing. All right. Thanks for listening. We'll be back.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.